This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, for the first time in history, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission orders the owner of a power dam to remove it so fish can migrate upstream. We meet the man who has piloted the Alden Research Submarine and made over 500 dives. Our ear to the ground builds trails and greenways with help from a government program everybody likes. In our continuing series on the Great American Harvest, we cut Christmas trees in Wisconsin, where this year's crop is being readied for the market. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. The Edwards Dam stretches 900 feet across the Kennebec River in Maine and is 19 feet high. It's said that author Nathaniel Hawthorne watched the structure being built in 1837, 160 years ago. The dam looks like it was built of Lincoln logs. Actually, it's a log crib which is filled with rocks. Now, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, says it has to go. FERC just denied the application of the Edwards Manufacturing Company and the City of Augusta, Maine, to relicense the hydropower dam. This is the first time in history FERC has done such a thing. I spoke with Steve Brook, project coordinator for the Kennebec Coalition, on the day the FERC decision was handed down. The coalition is comprised of environmental groups who have been working for this result for over a decade.
The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission issued for the first time an order that denied a new license and requires the removal of an operating dam. Since 1920, this is the first time that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has taken this type of an action. They did it because the Kennebec River in the Augusta area is a very unique and a very special resource. The agency has taken this action to balance the use of the river with the resources that are there in fisheries. Since 1987, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has been required to give equal consideration both to power values and to non-power values. And this is really one of the first major cases where FERC has very aggressively balanced this and decided that the river's value is free-flowing as greater value to society than it is as an impoundment generating a very small amount of power.
The dam is 42 miles upriver from the sea, and if removed, will open up additional critical miles of river for fish. Again, Steve Brook.
As the commission has looked at this, they've considered a wide range of things. They've considered how the power is easily replaced with existing local utilities. They consider the fact that removal is going to provide 9 species of fish with continuous access to 15 miles of very important spawning habitat. I think they feel that it's going to provide access to at least 4 species of fish that could never have used fish passage at this site on the river. I think that they've considered the fact that there are significant wetlands habitats that will benefit from this. They're considering the recreational, the boating, and the fishing industries that will benefit from this. And I think that they're also considering the fact that there are no major environmental or social drawbacks to this decision.
Before ordering its removal, FERC considered the feasibility of building fish ladders or other devices to let the fish get over or around the dam. Peter Raffel, communications director for Trout Unlimited, which was one of the groups in the Kennebec Coalition, said the numbers just don't work out.
The environmental impact statement estimated that adapting the dam to pass some of the fish would cost something like $10 million, and that removing the dam altogether would cost considerably less than that, just over half that amount. Also, the costs of trying to get some of the fish past the dam would eventually exceed the revenues that the power from the dam generated. So it really turned out to be an uneconomical project. The real kicker, though, was that certain species of fish couldn't get past the dam even with state-of-the-art fisheries passage devices, fish ladders, and that sort of thing. So the only hope for them was to remove the dam altogether.
The owner of the dam, Edwards Manufacturing Company, will appeal the FERC decision. Mark Isaacson, vice president of Edwards, thinks the decision to shut down a clean source of energy was wrong, and it was also wrong to require his company to remove the dam without compensation.
That is not the current system. The current system says that at the end of the term of license, either you get a new license or you get your net investment out of this project. And that is the bargain which every licensee accepts when they accept a license. It is also the bargain which the government accepts when it issues a license. And what is in effect happening here is that the government is attempting to get around its side of the bargain.
Steve Brook of the Kennebec Coalition believes the responsibility of a license holder is quite different.
This license has expired, and now the licensee is being asked to return the river to the public in the condition that it was before the dam was built. And it's only fair. I mean, once you've used somebody's public resource, you need to return it to them in an undamaged condition. So it's fair and it's appropriate that the licensees be required to remove this dam.
Everyone agrees that the Edwards Dam decision will not open a flood of license denials, but it does show that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is now taking seriously its responsibility to balance power interests with environmental concerns in the process of relicensing hydropower projects. Few oceanographic scientists will tell you that deep-sea research is easy. Visibility is poor and the environment is extreme. But for more than 30 years, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute has operated Alvin, a submarine that has assisted scientists in their efforts to better understand our oceans. While the submarine is small, its contributions to science have been significant. The Environment Show Stephen Westcott recently traveled to Woods Hole, Massachusetts, to talk with one of Alvin's pilots about his long relationship with this unique vehicle.
Dudley Foster, a mechanical engineer and former Navy jet pilot, came to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute on Cape Cod more than 30 years ago. At that time, the Alvin project was just coming together. His job was to help develop new equipment to be used with Alvin. Since then, Foster has become one of the sub's most experienced pilots. Just this past year, he took part on his 500th dive in the sub. Foster has been all over the world in places man has never been before. He says the most important part of being a submarine pilot is the ability to help yourself if trouble occurs, because rescue capabilities are minimal when you are thousands of feet below the surface.
One of my very early first training dives were, we went down on a dive, one of our other pilots at that time. He was just qualified as a pilot, but we'd gone down to pick up some rocks and science samples, and the variable ballast system we have, which allows the submarine to get heavier light. He decided we were a little bit light, so he turned the switch on to flood some water into some tanks to get a little bit lighter or get a little bit heavier, and continued to do some other manipulative tasks. And then the batteries were getting low, so we decided it was time to come up, but then he discovered that he left the switch on.
To make matters worse, the low batteries prohibited the pilot from flushing the water out. In the end, Foster says rock samples collected during the dive were removed, which allowed the sub to return to the surface. But had they not been successful in raising the sub, those on board may not have suffered the worst. Alvin is equipped with an eject button, something no other submersible in the world has.
The forward portion of the submarine, where the people are, which is the personnel sphere, can be released from the rest of the submarine. So it's like an ejection seat on an airplane like I used to fly. And the advantage of that is that if some volume in the submarine got flooded, like the problem I had, or if the submarine's after portion propellers get snagged in a cable or something that you can't get loose of. Any condition that would be where you drop the amount of weights that you could and you still couldn't get off the bottom, then that the pilot can turn a shaft in the bottom of the sphere 90 degrees, and then the forebody floats loose of the rest.
The sub is a little over 23 feet long, 12 feet high, and has a gross weight of 34,000 pounds. Alvin has the ability to dive 15,000 feet, enough to cover more than 80% of the ocean floor. Its cockpit is about 7 feet long, pretty tight quarters when you're carrying three people. While the dangerous conditions and sacrifices made by Foster and other scientists are great, the rewards are even greater. Foster says in its 30-year history, Alvin has been part of some very important oceanographic and geological findings, including the theory of plate tectonics.
Some people will disagree about when they decided that was a real something that really happened, not just a theory. And I think that the results of the work we're doing on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge was pretty definitive that plate tectonics was a reality, not just a theory. There are other people that think there were other physical properties that really had to be proven in order to support that theory, but I think the geology told the story.
In addition, Foster says Alvin provided scientists with their first look at hydrothermal vent blasts located off the coast of Mexico. The vents emit a mineral-rich black smoke that reaches temperatures of 650 degrees Fahrenheit. Foster says helping scientists from across the U.S. make new discoveries is very interesting and rewarding work. He says he doesn't dwell on the opportunities he has had too much, but when he does, they can be emotional recollections.
Because when you think about it, I'm looking out the window of Alvin when I'm moving along the bottom, and I'm seeing a few square meters of the Earth's surface that nobody else has ever seen in the history of mankind. And likely never will see again, because the oceans are so vast and the seafloors so vast that it's unlikely that anybody's going to go to that same very spot, see that same view. So that's pretty unique.
Foster was even able to view the Titanic three times in the 1980s, but today he is taking part in fewer dives. Much of his time now is spent on managerial and engineering work, something he doesn't mind since weeks at sea can take its toll even on the hardiest of souls. As for the future, Foster says he doesn't see more subs like Alvin being built. He says a lack of funding limits the research scientists can do at sea, which probably makes the research currently being conducted even more important. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. The Environment Show would like to hear from you. Who knows? We might even put you on the air. Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley.
I'm Linda Anderson, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, beyond the boundaries of the national park. Considered the most popular government agency, the National Park Service has been around since 1916. Its purpose is to take care of a number of federal properties, which today total more than 370 units. These include monuments, historic sites, battlefields, and most notably, the big parks like Yellowstone and Yosemite. All of these resources, explains Tom Ross, Assistant Director of the Park Service's Recreation and Conservation Division, are managed on the behalf of the American people. Yet it's not the only way the Park Service carries out its mission of protecting America's natural and cultural resources. Ross oversees a program called the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program, or RTCA.
The River Trails and Conservation Assistance Program was started back in the late 1980s through the work of one of our regional offices in principally working with river resources and working with local groups and organizations that were working to promote access and opportunities for recreation along rivers.
Or protecting rivers and streams or building trails for hiking and biking. Projects are done always through the invitation of a local organization, be it local governments or conservation groups. Ross says RTCA does not initiate any of the projects, but rather acts as a partner, providing technical assistance.
We go in and we work to build community, help build community consensus, help facilitate all the various interests in various particular resources. We share the kinds of experiences and the kind of things we've learned around the country and working with communities and organizations on benefits of things like trails and greenways and rivers. But in many cases, we are able to, because of our experience and our expertise, tap into a variety of funding sources.
For example, Ross says the RTCA worked in Portland, Maine, with citizens who wanted to reconnect part of the community that had been cut off by a roadway. Eventually, the project grew and led to the vision of a 30-mile network of trails within the city. Ross says through RTCA's assistance, the project was able to receive over $2.5 million from a variety of sources, including the Department of Transportation, neighborhood groups, and local businesses. Projects may range from only 1 month to several years, like the one in Portland. They can be in rural communities or urban ones. Whatever or wherever, Ross says the RTCA is helping communities rediscover those important natural and recreational resources in their own backyards or main streets.
Converting abandoned railroad corridors into trails, gaining access or preserving a river corridor that may have been used for industrial purposes and converting it now into a recreational area or conservation area. Providing trail networks through a community that open up the community to access by foot or by bicycle.
The RTCA program overall is very small. Ross says they get about half of 1% of the National Park Service budget, operating 20 offices around the country. There are more projects than they can handle, so there is a selection process. RTCA tries to have an equal mix of trails versus river projects, local versus statewide significance, and special consideration is given to projects facing development pressures. Groups interested in working with the RTCA should contact the National Park Service through a regional officer. Tom Ross says it's very important for people to realize how valuable the natural resources are in their own communities. Most Americans, he says, do not have the opportunity to visit national parks on a regular basis. But through programs like the Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program, Ross says the Park Service comes to where people live. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Linda Anderson.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. we continue our series on the Great American Harvest. As we broadcast, Christmas trees are being cut and distributed for the holiday season. While they're grown all over the United States, Wisconsin is one of the country's largest producers. Brad Miller is owner of the Christmas Tree Farm in Mindoro, Wisconsin, located on the western edge of the state along the Mississippi River. Miller says pruning is one of the most important parts of producing quality trees.
The pines, mostly long-needled trees such as white pine and Scotch pine, Norway pine. There are firs such as balsam fir, Fraser fir, white or concolor fir, and then there are the spruces, Colorado, white, black, Norway, and each has to be handled a little differently. The pines, which grow only from the end of the branch, that is, they have a bud on the end of the branch, and then each year that bud breaks and extends and then sets another bud, which becomes next year's growth, they must be trimmed probably in Wisconsin between early June and the end of July. If for some reason the tree is not trimmed within that period of time, then they're probably lost as Christmas trees. That is, they will have large gaps and large openings and will be unsaleable as Christmas trees.
Miller says fir and spruce trees have buds along each branch and can be trimmed any time they're not actively growing. Once the trees are ready for cutting, he has workers harvest the trees for both retail and wholesale distribution. But Miller says many people prefer the cut-your-own method, which has grown in popularity, especially in recent years.
Well, it's a real experience, and if the weather cooperates here in Wisconsin, obviously if it's 20 degree below wind chill, people don't want to be walking around in the woods cutting their own tree, but if the weather is acceptable, it can be a lot of fun. People come and make a whole day of it. They tailgate. They bring their pets. They bring grandma and grandpa. They bring the neighbors. They make a whole experience of it. The addition of horse-drawn sleigh rides on my farm has drawn a lot of people. I'll have people come and cut their tree and then come back later to ride on the sleigh with their kids. It becomes a source of tradition, I think, especially for young families, families with young children. Something I can look forward to every year and compare one year's experience with another.
Miller says for those preferring pre-cut trees, freshness is most important. He says consumers should first look at the needles.
If needles come off easily within your fingers, if they snap or are pulled from the tree without much resistance, then the tree is dry. That is the unusual situation to be found, I think, on a tree lot. What usually happens is the tree is taken home and then not cared for properly. It should have a fresh cut so that it'll draw water, and then it's critical that that cut always be kept below the water line. A fresh-cut Christmas tree, when first put up in a house, might take a gallon or more of water in the first day or two, and what happens typically is that people aren't conscious of the fact that the water reservoir in their stand has been depleted, and then that cut heals over and the tree will no longer draw water.
It takes between 7 and 12 years to produce a Christmas tree, depending on the species. But when the tree is harvested, consumers receive instant gratification. And unlike some forestry, Christmas tree growing is an example of sustainable agriculture. So enjoy your tree, and we'll give you a green tip at a later show on how to dispose of it. Unless, of course, you want to keep it up all year round. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Berling. Still ahead, an irrigation engineer from Zimbabwe says one of the challenges is building canals with animal escapes so antelope and wildebeests don't drown. We talk green about global warming and nuclear power. Will efforts to limit fossil fuel use resuscitate the ailing nuclear industry? And author David Peterson takes us to his special place in southern Colorado, where the aspen trees define the seasons. Now it's summertime in Zimbabwe, Africa. It rains at this time of year, typically in torrential amounts for about 40 minutes, starting in the early afternoon, which is then followed by light showers. This follows a heat buildup in the morning. During the Zimbabwe winter, from April through mid-October, there is no rainfall, so irrigation is vital to Zimbabwe's agricultural production. John Pagioli is an irrigation engineer. A native of Zimbabwe, he lives in Harare and is area manager for Central Africa for Ranggood International, a multinational company that sells irrigation equipment.
We have no rainfall from about April right through till middle of October. That is considered our winter months. So irrigation on crops like wheat is very, very important. Our main crop is tobacco, and they start planting it in October, which they start to pre-irrigate to bring the soils up to what they call field capacity. Various forms of irrigation have taken place over the years, the first one being flood, and still one of the most commonly used throughout Zimbabwe. In our southern region, where we have sugarcane, we have mainly all flood irrigation, with now more and more sprinkler irrigation being introduced.
Pagioli says the big irrigation canals can present difficulties for large wild animals, such as antelope, impala, kudu, eland, and wildebeests, and also for smaller wildlife like baboons, wild dogs, and jackals.
We are very careful about putting in what we call animal escapes. Because of the size of these canals, it's in an area where there are a lot of animals, and to try and make sure that a large percentage of them, they will want to come and drink water, they will try and jump the canal, and unfortunately some will get caught in it. However, every kilometer along these big canals, we have what we call animal escapes. That's to ensure that if a large antelope goes in, there is a 98% chance that it'll come out at one of these animal escapes.
An animal escape consists of a series of steps which enable the beast to climb out of the water and over the canal bank. Electric power to drive irrigation pumps come largely from the Kariba Dam. Pagioli says as more dams have been built recently, Zimbabwe has given greater consideration to the downstream environmental impact of the dams.
Back in the early 1960s, when Kariba Dam was first constructed, I would say yes, they didn't think about those kind of ecological problems. And there was Operation Noah, which was put into practice because of the flooding, to move the animals, because those were the ones mostly affected, and the people in that area, in terms of resettlement to areas that were where the waters wouldn't reach. Now, I think Zimbabwe has learned a huge lesson from that. And where dams are constructed, it's basically where there is a crying need for water, mainly purely for, never mind irrigation, but for people living and working in that area.
Pagioli says another thing that is changing is that international companies, such as the one that he works for, are bringing a stronger commitment to the environment than was the case in the past.
Very much they're very concerned about the environment, and in my experience, which is very, very, very good to see. And I think this is a considerable change to 20 years ago. they definitely have a much higher concern for what is happening around them in that country, and which is very pleasing and is one of the reasons why the Zimbabwe government is encouraging more and more investment in that area.
In Pagioli's opinion, agriculture in Zimbabwe in its current form is sustainable. While tobacco, sugar, and corn are major crops, he foresees an increase in the production of citrus, macadamia nuts, mangoes, asparagus, tomatoes, and cabbages for markets in Europe and South Africa. This will come about as more efficient irrigation techniques are put into practice. We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about climate change, reduction of carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas emissions, and nuclear energy. In anticipation of the Kyoto Conference on climate change, a lot of material has been disseminated by the nuclear power industry to the effect that nuclear power is indeed the way to keep the lights on without adding to carbon dioxide emissions. And so the question is, should concern about climate change cause us to take another look at nuclear power? Or, perhaps less charitably, is climate change merely a twig that an inefficient and environmentally undesirable dinosaur, i.e. the nuclear power industry, is grasping at as it sinks into extinction in the swamp? That should generate some comment. We want to hear your views. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. And I have two guests with me today. One is Scott Peterson, and he is Senior Director of External Communications for the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is a nuclear energy industry group. And Alka Piersma, he is Energy Policy Analyst for the Public Citizen Critical Mass Energy Project. Public Citizen is a consumer and anti-nuclear group. And they're both with us from Washington, D.C. So I'd like to start with you, Scott Peterson, from the Nuclear Energy Institute. Is nuclear energy an appropriate way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, absolutely, Peter. In fact, we've got a long history of doing just that. Since plants began coming online about 40 years ago, nuclear energy has, in fact, been the clean air alternative to climate change. And we think the world's need for nuclear energy is likely to be the subtext, in fact, of climate change talks in Kyoto in December. In the United States, we've got more than 100 nuclear energy plants generating about 20% of our electricity today, which is by far the cleanest source of electricity that we have. If you look at the carbon dioxide reductions that have taken place in this country since 1973 in the electric utility industry, nuclear energy is responsible for 90% of those reductions.
Okay. Well, Alka Piersma from the Public Citizen Critical Mass Energy Project, I would presume you have probably see this somewhat differently.
Yeah, and indeed we do. I think there are two major issues to nuclear power as the answer to climate change. It's funny. I think this is one of the few times the nuclear industry and public citizen agree on an issue in terms of climate change being a problem that we have to address. However, we're concerned with nuclear power as the answer, and essentially it comes down to two things. One, economics, which everyone needs to talk about, and the second one, of course, is nuclear waste.
I would like to look at the economic issue, since I gather we also all agree that if you do produce electricity through nuclear power, you're not adding to greenhouse gases. But I think we all agree that whatever is done has got to be economically sound. Scott, we see nuclear power plants closing all over the United States for a major reason, and that is that economically they just can't cut it. They can't generate electricity on an economic basis in a competitive market. How do you cope with that at the same time one advocates that we expand this is an energy source.
Well, if I can just correct one point, we've had less than a handful of plants shut down in recent years because of economics. And what we're facing now in the electric utility industry is a move toward deregulation in the states. And from a competitive standpoint, we see that as good news for the nuclear energy industry. When you look at the price of electricity and how that's going to be marketed in this new climate, it's going to be based on production costs of how cheaply can you produce electricity based on things like operating and maintenance and fuel costs. When you look at nuclear energy, it costs on average about 1.9 cents per kilowatt hour for us to produce electricity at nuclear power plants. That's essentially equal to coal as the lowest cost producer and is far ahead of natural gas, which is about 3.5 cents. So when you look at the cost of producing nuclear energy now and going forward into a competitive environment, we see that as a very favorable environment for nuclear power to continue to operate.
Okay, does that match your look at the numbers?
Not quite. The only way nuclear power is going to be competitive in a open competition market is by bailing them out first, and that's what they're asking for. They're asking for what they term stranded costs, which essentially is everybody in their local utility base have to pay them extra money just because. And the problem with that is that, you know, we don't think you should be bailing out industry and then turn around and say the industry is economic. It doesn't make sense.
And so, Scott, how do you deal with that stranded cost issue if it's not by charging the ratepayer?
Well, you look at stranded costs and exactly what that is. And what that is recovering the cost of the plants that the utilities have paid ahead of time, that each state regulator of utility industry says, okay, we'll give the utility 40 years to recover these costs. It's an established way of doing business, and it's something that they'll have to deal with not only with nuclear power plants, but with coal plants and with a lot of energy efficiency and low-income heating and cooling programs. So we think that these costs have already been judged prudent in each state. The states that have passed legislation so far to deregulate the nuclear power industry and the electricity industry as a whole have recognized that these costs are indeed prudent and that they should be paid for as we transition into a competitive environment.
But before we get to the environmental piece, which is really what this show is about, we did a story quite recently for the Environment Show about a plant in Connecticut in which was being decommissioned, and yet the costs that was going to involve, the money that it was going to take that thing apart,
mm-hmm.
Exceeded the reserves that they had to do that by a factor of 100% or more, so that the costs seemed to be huge to take the thing apart, and that raised some real questions, at least in my mind, as to whether this whole thing was economic or not.
Well, there are costs involved with decommissioning, and rightfully so, that sometimes they are large costs because you want to return the site to the condition in which you found it. Utilities do cover these costs over the lifetime of the plant, and as operation goes forward, every so often they check the fund to make sure that it's in line with what it's going to cost to decommission the plant. One of the issues that you have when you do shut down early, as the plant in Connecticut did, is you may not have had sufficient time to recover those costs if you have an early shutdown. In fact, that's one of the important issues that the industry has moving forward, is to ensure that as we go into competition and we go into deregulation, that these costs are, again, something that is provided for as we move forward in the same fair mechanism that they're required for now.
But that Connecticut shutdown was occasioned, at least according to the folk running the plant, was they just couldn't hack it economically anymore. It just couldn't sell the stuff at a price that would let it go. But let's go to the environmental issue. Alcov, let's suppose Tim Wirth or whoever is going to be heading the delegation calls you up and says succinctly, why shouldn't, from an environmental perspective, we look at the nuclear option as an effective means of reducing greenhouse gas emissions?
Two words, nuclear waste. Essentially, you think about it, you compare it to the tobacco industry, and it's like giving up smoking by taking up crack. I mean, that's the comparison to make here. Climate changes is a serious issue, but nuclear waste is potentially a much worse issue. Radioactive nuclear waste that comes out of reactors lasts a million years, and nobody has any concept of how to deal with this in the long term. The federal government currently is studying a site to try to attempt to bury it. But even if you think about burying nuclear waste for a million years, you can't comprehend what needs to happen for that million years to make sure the waste stays there and doesn't come up and contaminate anybody or contaminate, even worse, drinking water.
And so from your perspective, the waste issue alone means that we just got to do this in other ways.
Exactly.
And, Scott, when you look at the nuclear waste issue, where are places that you think it's doing right, which would being done right, which would justify continuing the effort?
Well, when you look at managing the used fuel from these facilities, there's international scientific consensus that it can be done safely. And it's not a technical problem. It's more of a political problem and one of political will here in the United States. But the commonly accepted method of managing this fuel is deep geologic burial. Not only, but they don't put the fuel in the ground by itself. They encase it in a robust canister that has been designed, has been tested, has been licensed and approved by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And these canisters are designed to last and designed to keep the radiation inside the cask and not let it leak out.
But when you say this is a political problem, we live in a political world in which, in a democracy, people express their views. If nobody wants to put this stuff in their backyard, do we need to tell them to do it anyway?
Well, what you have now is you have the responsibility of the federal government to accept this fuel. That's been a long-standing responsibility since the Atomic Energy Act in 1954. Both houses of the Congress this year have passed legislation to give the Department of Energy a sensible plan to move forward with this. The only thing now that steps in the way is the White House, which has threatened to veto the bill. We think that the White House should drop its veto threat and sign the legislation that's coming out of Congress with strong bipartisan support.
But wasn't, again, back to the politics, wasn't one of the things that was happening here was a Republican Congress was putting this into Nevada, where you have a couple of Democratic senators who opposed it vigorously, but and who got the president on their side.
Well, the Congress was reacting to the science that they had in front of them, and when the Department of Energy sent its scientists to look at three potential sites back in the 1980s, they sent back a report, and in that scientific report, in nearly every case, the site in Nevada, Yucca Mountain, which DOE continues to study today, came out the top in every technical scientific criteria that they looked at.
Alka, what we're hearing is that scientifically this is a problem that's solved or has been solved, and therefore all we've got to do is worry about the politics. Do you agree with that?
No, I think that while politics is playing a key role here, the scientific debate is far from over. First of all, you have to understand that Yucca Mountain is, which is the site they're proposing to bury the waste in, is by no means a done deal. There are several major scientific uncertainties in the mountain, the least of which is implications of rainwater coming down from the surface at a much faster rate than they expected previously. There's also issues of earthquakes with major fault zones running through the mountain, and yet we think it's safe to put nuclear waste there.
Let's move aside from Yucca for a moment and think again about climate change. The U.S. is not the only country that wrestles with the nuclear issue. We see a huge amount of power being planned and contemplated in developing countries. What other alternatives do they have? What should the negotiating posture be at Kyoto when the United States comes to grips with this? Again, Alka, let's start with you. What do you think the U.S. should be saying?
I think the U.S. should take a much stronger stance than they have already. They should disregard the industry claims that this will cost us our economic well-being. Clearly, that's not true. And the U.S. should see itself as an environmental nation, and we should push forward this debate. It's clear that energy efficiency and renewable energy can take a much stronger role in dealing with this issue.
And, Scott, what is the industry saying to the U.S. about the position it should take and also to developing countries who are looking at this issue perhaps more seriously than we are?
Well, I think we agree with ALCA in terms that there is a need for renewable sources and efficiency, but you have to take a long look at baseload power, the large sources of electricity, and some of these countries like Japan have limited natural resources to generate electricity with. So nuclear power is an important source to them. Japan is already 34% nuclear, and they have announced that they're going to order another 20 nuclear plants just to meet their clean air goals. China is doing the same thing. It has an enormous air quality problem with all the coal that it burns. And it, during the recent U.S.-China summit, President Clinton authorized the sale of U.S. reactors to China as one way that it can combat its air quality problem. And they plan to build two nuclear plants a year through the year 2020, which is a very significant program.
Okay, it sounds as though a lot of people elsewhere are moving forward pretty fast. Are there alternatives that we should be offering them?
Clearly, I think the U.S. Would be much better served by offering up its incredible lead in what it already has in energy efficiency. If the U.S. energy efficiency market were to surge forward, we'd create a lot more jobs back home than if the nuclear power market were to surge forward. And more importantly, we would protect the world from nuclear waste and from proliferation concerns that are a part of all this debate.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid our time is up. I've been talking with Scott Peterson, who is Senior Director of External Communications of the Nuclear Energy Institute, and ALCA Piersma, who is with Public Citizen Critical Mass Energy Project. We've been discussing global warming and nuclear energy. We'd like to hear your views. Call us at 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime through our webpage and also talk to us. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Send us an email at green@wamc.org. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author David Peterson, it's the mountains of southern Colorado. His new book is entitled The Nearby Far Away. Reading from a section of his book, Autumn Aspen Haiku, Peterson presents a portrait of the seasonal changes in this pristine landscape.
During all the young years I fretted in cities, I counted the turning of the seasons by calendar pages. Since moving to the southern Colorado Rockies nearly 20 years ago, I've learned to rely on nature as my calendar, the trees in particular, here in the quaking aspen forest I call home. Springtime begins the day the winter's snow has melted sufficiently to reveal the first pink, delicate wildflower, Claytonia, and becomes official when the aspen catkins burst, releasing seed to the wind. Summer arrives on the wings of scarlet and yellow western tanagers, timed to the leafing of the aspens. Autumn, simultaneously the saddest and most sublime of seasons, is heralded by the brassy bugling of rutting bull elk and mountains set aflame with dying aspens. Early as August, yellow leaves begin dotting the ground, though no visible sign of change is apparent in the lime-green canopy of the groves. By month's end, however, these southern mountains are near solid gold, with one of the most beautiful processes in nature having begun. Given favorable conditions, this shimmering glory can linger well into October. Thus is recited the annual Autumn Aspen Haiku. Yellow leaf flutters to forest floor. Nowhere is death more beautiful. Finally, inevitably, winter returns with the first major snowstorm, bleaching the mountains of their residual brilliance and reducing the Quakies to stark naked skeletons. This year, winter's first storm arrives at night, in a boisterous Arctic howl. Flake by perfect flake, the wet white sleets down, piling up until, by morning, many younger, still flexible aspens are bowed tips to ground, like so many horseshoes turned open ends down, their luck spilling out. When a foot has accumulated, a few aging, ailing Quakies, their resolve dissolved in the face of another long mountain winter, release their existential rootings and make slow, somber pratfalls to stasis. At a snow depth of 2 feet, more aspens, middle-aged, healthy-looking, roots firmly rooted but torsos gone rigid with arthritic disposition, try to resist the indomitable force of mass times gravity, are overwhelmed, snap clean in two, and their tops come crashing down. I hear the rifle cracks of these violent decapitations almost every time I venture out into the frigid night to melt snow with used coffee. On the second morning, the storm having blown itself out, I strap on snowshoes and trudge around inspecting the pale corpses of broke-backed trees. In the marrow of every last one is exposed the punky tissue diagnostic of aspen heart rot. A discreet and efficient predator is winter's first storm, culling the feeble, the inflexible, the irresolute, a sharp-fanged wolf at work amongst a bloated flock. It's a seeming disaster now, but come spring, the survivors will emerge leaner, stronger, straightening, stretching, flexing, reaching for the sun, enjoying more room to grow and prosper, the vigorous products of adversity endured. Aspen as exemplar.
That was author David Peterson reading from his latest book entitled The Nearby Far Away. It's published by Johnson Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Don't buy that used nuclear power plant without a copy of the program. Call 1-888-49-GREEN and ask for show number 414. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Producers are Rachel Phillips and Stephen Westcott. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, Bob and Marilyn Schumann, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.